And yes, as Manjunatha also said, in India, in Kalimpong, I did meet many remarkable people of all sorts, all nationalities, races, religions, social positions. And yes, again, he's dead right. You're going to meet one or two of them this evening as I read a short extract from this newest volume of memoirs. After all the people I met during that period, definitely one of the most remarkable, one of the most interesting was Lama Govinda. Well, perhaps I should say not just Lama Govinda, but Lama Govinda and his wife, Li Gotami. In the course of the 3 years with which this volume of memoirs deals, I met them no less than 4 times. We met for the first time in Kalimpong when they came and spent a week with me at the Hermitage. Then I went straight after that with them to Ghum near Darjeeling, where Lama Govinda met his teacher many years earlier, and spent a week with them. Then the third time we met at Sanchi on the occasion of the re-enshrinement of the relics of Sariputra and Moggallana. We spent several days together then, and straight after that, or very nearly straight after that, I joined them in their new home in Deolali, 100 miles to the northeast of Bombay, and spent another week with them there. I did meet them on many other occasions afterwards, but that occasion in Deolali was the fourth and last to be described in this present volume of memoirs. So I'm going to read you just a few pages describing that week that the three of us spent together in Deolali. I just spent some time in Bombay, and a friend of mine, a young Punjabi script writer, drove me to Deolali, drove me to the Barnes High School in the Gate Lodge, of which Lama Govinda and Li Gotami had installed themselves. So just imagine myself and my friend Rashk arriving by car after a quite long 5-hour, rather dusty journey from Bombay. Barnes High School, Deolali, seems to be situated miles from the cantonment, while the Gate Lodge itself, into which Lama Govinda and Li Gotami had moved some months earlier, seems to be situated miles from the school. A grey stone building, obviously dating from the time of the Raj, it straddles the road with what could only be described as an air of defiance. As Rashk and I drew up in its shadow 4 or 5 hours after leaving Chembur, a door at the foot of one of its flanking towers flew open, and Lama Govinda and Li Gotami issued forth to greet us and lead us upstairs to the range of spacious rooms that they occupied immediately above the road. Rashk was, I could see, a little taken aback by my two friends' colourful and exotic appearance, as it must have seemed to Indian eyes, and obviously did not know quite what to make of them at first. But so warm and friendly was their treatment of him that by the end of the meal, which, at their insistence, he stayed and shared, he was clearly very much prepossessed in their favour. Before he left, it was agreed between us that he should come and collect me in a week's time and drive me back to Bombay, whence I would make my way to Kalimpong. As soon as he had gone, my hosts and I took up the thread of the talk we had been obliged to cut short in Sanchi, and before long were deep in discussion. It was a discussion that not only lasted far into the night, but continued during the days that followed almost without interruption. The only real interruptions, in fact, were when either Lama Govinda or Lee Gotami had to go and take a class at Barnes High School. As in Kalimpong and Ghum, we ranged over practically the whole field of Buddhist life and thought, with particular reference to the relation between Buddhism and the spiritual life on the one hand, and literature and the fine arts on the other. But though we ranged so widely, there was one topic to which both Lama Govinda and Lee Gotami came back again and again, and which they both seemed, in fact, to have very much in mind. This was the topic of the Tsaparang expedition, the journey they had made in 1948-49 to the ruined temples of the former capital of Western Tibet. During the week that he and Lee Gotami had spent with me in Kalimpong, Lama Govinda had, of course, given a talk on the Tsaparang expedition, a talk he had illustrated by showing a number of his own paintings and sketches, many of them executed on the spot. Lee Gotami, for her part, had shown the tracings she had made of frescoes depicting the life of the Buddha, tracings from which she hoped to produce copies of the frescoes, while Lama Govinda had given a running commentary on the different episodes in the Buddha's career that the frescoes depicted. Lee herself had given neither talk nor commentary, being apparently averse to speaking in public. But she now made up for this by giving me her account of the Tsaparang expedition, dwelling in characteristically lively and entertaining fashion on difficulties at which Govinda had only hinted, or of which he had made no mention. Difficulties at which, in retrospect, both she and he could laugh, but which had been very serious at the time. One of their biggest difficulties, I gathered, was that of dealing with sullen, uncooperative porters and drunken, unreliable guides. The task of dealing with them had increasingly devolved upon Lee herself, who spoke fluent bizarre Hindi, and who, in the course of the journey, managed to pick up enough colloquial Tibetan for practical purposes. Enough, that is to say, to give orders and bestow abuse. Lama Govinda's Hindi was rudimentary, despite his long residence in India, and though he could read Tibetan religious texts, he was unable to speak the language. After hearing Lee's vivid description of how, week after week, she had struggled with the logistics of the expedition, supervising the loading and unloading of mules and yaks, and organizing the crossing of rivers, I could not forbear asking, but what did Lama Govinda do? Oh, he did the cooking, she replied, shrieking with laughter at the recollection, as the Lama himself smiled. The reply did not surprise me. I had already noticed that at Deolali itself, it was Govinda who did the cooking, while Lee made the beds and swept the floor. He was quite a good cook, though, as he explained to me one morning, he never spent more than half an hour in the actual preparation of a meal. Having chopped his vegetables and washed his rice and lentils, he popped them into the steam cooker and left them to boil while he carried on writing or painting. Long practice had, he assured me, enabled him to calculate exactly how much time was needed to cook a particular meal, so that lunch or dinner was always ready precisely when he and Lee wanted to have it. As he explained all this to me, and indeed showed me just how he distributed the vegetables, rice and lentils among the aluminium containers, and how he got the charcoal fire going in the little burner, I was reminded of those two solitary weeks at the Raipur ashram when I myself had cooked with the help of a patent steam cooker, weeks during which my two friends were seeking permission to enter Western Tibet. Li Gotami, by her own laughing admission, knew next to nothing about cooking. The Parsi family into which she had been born was a wealthy one. She had grown up surrounded by servants, and until her marriage to Lama Govinda, she had had to make hardly so much as a cup of tea herself. Thus, it was Govinda who did the cooking, and Li who made the beds and swept the floor. In their relationship, there was, indeed, a certain reversal of the usual roles, with Li sometimes taking the more active masculine role, and Govinda the more passive feminine one. This may well have had something to do with the fact that Li was 20 years younger than her husband, whose student she had once been, and was possessed of an abundance of natural vigour. Whatever the explanation, there seems to be little doubt that, on the mundane level at least, she had been the principal driving force behind the Tsarpurang expedition, and that without her to cajole and bully on his behalf, the gentle, retiring Lama would never have seen Lake Manasarovar and Mount Kailash, never have seen the Valley of the Moon Castle, never have seen the frescoes of Terling and Tsarpurang, and in all probability would never have written The Way of the White Clouds. But often as Li might take the masculine role, she was by no means devoid of feminine qualities. On the Tsarpurang expedition itself, there had been occasions when these were very much in evidence. Some of the frescoes of which she wanted to make tracings were situated high up on the wall, just below the ceiling. In order to get at them, she had to sit perched on a pile of stones that she and Lama Govinda dismantled and rebuilt at a slightly different spot each morning. It was bitterly cold. One day, Govinda recalled, he had looked up from his own work to see that Li was so cold and miserable that she was crying, and that her tears were actually freezing before they had time to reach the ground. Such was the vividness of his description that in my mind's eye I could see the unhappy Li perched aloft on her pile of stones like some latter-day female Stylites and weeping diamonds. Li laughed as Govinda told the story, but I noticed that there were tears in her eyes, as if she were re-experiencing, rather than just recollecting, the tribulations she had had to undergo in order to make her tracings. "Oh, yes," she exclaimed, dashing a stray drop of moisture from her cheek. Her tears really had frozen. But that was not the worst of it. The Chinese ink she had been using to make the tracings had also frozen, and she had had to keep on warming the tip of her brush with her breath. In view of the enormous effort that had gone into the making of them, as well as on account of their intrinsic value to lovers of Buddhist art, it was not surprising that Li Gotami should be quite protective towards her tracings, as I had indeed observed in Kalimpong. She was even more protective towards the copies of the original frescoes on which she had been working for the last year or more, but especially after Lama Govinda and herself had settled in Diolali. Only one of these copies was actually finished, though there were two others on which she was working. And when I had been with them for 2 or 3 days, Govinda prevailed upon her to show it to me, which, with many protestations of its inadequacy, she eventually did. Approximately 3 feet by 2, which were the dimensions of the original fresco panel, it depicted the Buddha's victory over the hosts of Mara, immediately prior to his attainment of supreme enlightenment, and was remarkable for both richness of colour and delicacy of detail. As Govinda explained, the art of Tsaparang could be regarded as constituting a distinct stage in the evolution of Buddhist art, a stage that was intermediate between the latest frescoes of Ajanta and the earliest frescoes and painted scrolls of Tibet proper. The discovery of Tsaparang had, in fact, made possible the writing of a missing chapter in the history of Buddhist art, and its importance could hardly be overestimated. Li, having shown me her first finished fresco copy and received my warm congratulations on what she had so far done and my strong encouragements to produce copies of all the frescoes of which she had made tracings, in the event she succeeded in producing only 3 altogether, it was Govinda's turn to show me the originals of what he called his cosmic abstracts or meditation pictures. I was already familiar with these, having seen reproductions of at least some of them in his little book on art and meditation, afterwards incorporated into Creative Meditation and Multidimensional Consciousness. But no reproduction could do justice to the glowing hues of the colour drawings he now carefully drew out from beneath their sheets of protective tissue paper. They were executed in oil pastels, a medium with which I was then unacquainted, but which seems to be a favourite one with Govinda. I must have commented on the fact, for he proceeded to explain how simple and easy oil pastels were to use, and how convenient they were when one had no permanent studio and was forever on the move. Moreover, with oil pastels, it was possible to obtain effects that could not be obtained with either oil paints or watercolours. Unfortunately, they were effects that could not be reproduced by any mechanical means. None of the printers he had dealt with had been able to achieve more than an approximation to the colour values of his cosmic abstracts and other oil pastel drawings. Some had been unable to achieve even an approximation. Talk about printers must have led to talk about publishers, and talk about publishers must in turn have led to talk about editors, especially magazine editors. For Lama Govinda proceeded to tell me about an unpleasant interview which he and Lee had recently had in Bombay with the editor of the Illustrated Weekly of India. As I already knew, it was the Illustrated that had sponsored the Tsaparang expedition, and they had agreed to sponsor it because, as Lama Govinda had explained to Mr. Mandy, the editor, at the time, the long-deserted temples of Western Tibet were unknown to modern scholarship, so that in visiting Tsaparang and documenting its artistic treasures, he and Li Gotami would be doing something that had not been done before. They would, in effect, be discovering Tsaparang, discovering it for Renaissance India and for the world. Shortly before our reunion in Sanchi, however, Mr. Mandy had summoned them to his office and virtually accused Lama Govinda of having misled him and obtained the sponsorship of the Illustrated on false pretenses. The temples of Western Tibet had not been unknown to modern scholarship, and he and Li Gotami had not done something that had not been done before. They had not discovered Sapurang. Professor Tucci of Rome had discovered it. Professor Tucci, as he had recently learned, had led an expedition to Sapurang a decade or more before they had done. He had visited the very temples that they had visited, had photographed the images and frescoes there, and had published the results of his researches in a book. The news and the accusation had shocked and distressed Govinda, and, as I could see from the way he spoke of the matter, distressed him still. It had not been difficult to convince Mandy that he had not intended to mislead him, and that, strange as it might seem, he had been completely unaware of the fact of Tucci's having visited Sapurang, but it distressed him to think that he had misled him even unintentionally. Moreover, it had not been possible to convince Mandy that he had not intended to mislead him without admitting that he was less than well informed in the field in which he had represented himself as being an authority. In order to salvage his credibility as a man, he had had to sacrifice his reputation as a scholar. This too had distressed him, and distressed him still. But he was also puzzled. How could he not have known that Tucci had visited Sapurang, he exclaimed, with more feeling than I had yet seen him exhibit. He simply could not understand it. He could only assume that owing to his reclusive existence, not to mention his internment, he had, over the years, become cut off from the international scholarly community to a greater extent than he had realized, and that much was happening in the way of exploration and publication of which he had no knowledge. Naturally, I sympathized with Govinda. I sympathized with his distress at Mandy's accusation and at the harm that had been done, not permanently, I hoped, to his scholarly reputation. I also understood his puzzlement and sympathized with the predicament in which he found himself. The predicament of the artist scholar who wished to live as a recluse, but who, at the same time, wanted to know what was happening in the world, at least within the sphere of his own special interests. His predicament was, in a way, my own. Living in Kalimpong as I did, I had cut myself off from the various cultural and religious movements then in progress in Western Europe, movements with which, had I returned to Britain after the war, instead of becoming a homeless wanderer in India, I might well have become involved. I had even cut myself off from the nascent British Buddhist movement. But I had no regrets, any more than Govinda really had. A reclusive existence, whether in Deolali or in Kalimpong, might indeed have its disadvantages. But the German artist scholar and the English poet monk were agreed that those advantages were far outweighed by the advantages. Li Gotami must have been out when Lama Govinda told me about their interview with the editor of the Illustrated Weekly of India. She must have been out either teaching at Barnes High School or shopping in the cantonment bazaar, because Govinda was able to tell me about the interview without being interrupted. When the three of us had been together in Kalimpong and Goom and in Sanchi, the lively, pugnacious little Parsi woman must have been on her best behaviour, so to speak, for as far as I could remember, she had never interrupted her husband while he was talking. In Deolali, it was quite another story. Probably because she now knew me better and felt less inhibited by my presence, she interrupted and contradicted the poor Lama incessantly, this apparently being her normal way of relating to him. If he happens to recall how they had gone somewhere or seen somebody on a Thursday, she would be sure to interrupt him in mid-sentence with, "No, it was on a Wednesday. I'm sure it was on a Wednesday." "No, darling," he would reply, sometimes raising his hand in mild remonstrance, "it was a Thursday. It must have been on a Thursday because..." And he would proceed to remind her that the visit or meeting in question had taken place under such and such circumstances, and that, the circumstances being as they were, it must have taken place on a Thursday and could not possibly have taken place on a Wednesday. Sometimes it took Govinda several minutes to convince his argumentative helpmeet that he was right and she wrong, as was invariably the case. Once he had convinced her, she would lapse into silence, and he would resume his discourse until the next interruption. Lee seemed not to mind being continually proved wrong in this way. For his part, Lama Govinda seemed not to mind her constant interruptions and corrected her with his usual combination of firmness and gentleness. I noticed, though, that on such occasions he invariably addressed her as darling, as if this was as near as he could get to expressing his irritation. I also noticed, as I think I had noticed in Kalimpong, that Lee usually addressed him as what sounded like Ken. What did this mean? Was Ken the diminutive of Kenneth? In which case, by what freak of feminine fancy had Lee chosen so to denominate her spouse? Or perhaps it was not Ken, but Ken. Kenpo being the Tibetan word for abbot. Though in that case, Govinda would have been the abbot of a very small cenobium indeed, consisting of himself and Lee and the gate lodge cat. However, I did not think it proper to ask Lee why she addressed Govinda as Ken or Ken, either then or at any other of my subsequent meetings with them. It was perhaps a delicate question, of the kind with which I was so familiar in Kalimpong, and the mystery remained unsolved. Whatever mystery there may have been about the way in which Lee Gotami addressed Lama Govinda, there was no mystery about the way in which she addressed me. She addressed me simply as Rakshita, or Rakshita Ji. Govinda never permitted himself to shorten my monastic name in this manner, either then or afterwards. Like the freedom with which she now interrupted her husband in my presence, her addressing me as Rakshita was no doubt due to the fact that she now knew me better. Since she knew me better, she could speak more freely, and since she could speak more freely, it was not surprising that one afternoon, when she was perhaps tired of the doctrinal discussions in which Govinda and I tended to become involved, she should have started talking about her school days in England. She had been educated at Roedean, the well-known public school for girls near Brighton, and had enjoyed her time there immensely. Indeed, from what she said, it was clear that the young Lee Gotomy must have been a jolly hockey sticks sort of girl, and extremely popular. Before her arrival, she related with hoots of laughter, the other girls had been told that a little Indian princess was coming to study with them. Though Lee came from a wealthy family and had an uncle who had been knighted, she was certainly not a princess, and the girls had been quite disappointed. Nonetheless, they made a great fuss of her, and she soon felt at home among them. Having been educated at Roedean, Lee was in some ways quite westernized, even anglicized. Govinda, on the other hand, after 20 years of study and teaching at Shantiniketan and Saranath, Patna and Ghum, was quite orientalized, even Indianized, though not so much in his personal habits as in respect of his philosophical outlook and religious beliefs. As for myself, I had spent only 6 years in India, two of them as a wandering ascetic, but I was already quite Indianized, in some ways perhaps to a greater extent than Govinda. Thus, each of us represented a combination in varying proportions of the Eastern and the Western, India and Europe. Each of us had created, was in process of creating, his or her personal synthesis of modern culture and ancient spiritual tradition. As such, we had a great deal in common, even apart from our common allegiance to Buddhism. It was therefore not surprising that the week I spent with Lama Govinda and Lee Gotomy in Diwali should have passed quickly, at least for me, and that by the time Rushk came to collect me, I should have felt that our tripartite friendship was stronger than ever. So much then for Lama Govinda and Lee Gotomy, and there's quite a bit more about them in Facing Mount Kanchenjunga. But I'm going to read you now just a very short selection of poems written when I was, quite literally, facing Mount Kanchenjunga, written during the 3 years with which the volume of memoirs itself deals. I'm going to start off with a very short poem about mountains themselves, the mountains of Kalimpong, especially the snow peaks, meant a very great deal to me at that time. Very often I saw them, that is to say, saw the snow peaks practically every day, and they were a great source of inspiration and upliftment. So it's not surprising that quite soon after my arrival in Kalimpong, having lived with these mountains for a few months, I should have burst into song, so to speak, in the following manner. The poem's called simply Mountains. Golden in laughing sunlight, silver in mist and rain, I see thee, mighty mountains, tower heavenward from the plain. And pray my heart unmoved by sweet joys or sufferings dire, like thee through cloud and sunlight may upward still aspire. We didn't always see the snows, didn't always even see the mountains. Very often everything was covered in white mist. And the next poem's just about that white mist. It doesn't have a proper title. The title is simply the first line. White mist drifts down the valley dim. white mist drifts down the valley dim, then spreads and rises noiselessly, and the blue hilltops seem to swim like islands in a spectral sea. Swiftly the silver edges rise until the white waves overflow the shadowy hills, and with the skies make one vast sheet as though of snow. One moment all the world seems white, a pearly whiteness tinged with blue, till the fierce storm gods rush and smite that sea of massing cloud in two. Oh, when, with darkness overhead, in two vast waves they roll apart, a river like a silver thread gleams on the valleys as your heart. Well, enough of mountains and mist. Perhaps we'd better meet a few people. Perhaps we'd better meet a few ordinary people. Most of the people in Kalimpong were Nepalese, and many of those Nepalese were coolies, labourers, and many of them were engaged in burning charcoal, burning wood for charcoal, that is to say, down in the plains just below Kalimpong, and then bringing it up in baskets on their backs to the Kalimpong bazaar late at night for sale in the bazaar early next morning. In Kalimpong there was no electricity or gas for cooking purposes. Cooking and heating depended entirely upon charcoal and a little bit of ordinary wood. So the charcoal burners were kept very busy. The coolies were kept very busy bringing it up from the plains. And they used to see these coolies, these charcoal burners, with their baskets of charcoal, going in procession, as it were, at least twice a week, up to the Kalimpong Bazaar, ready for market day. And one day I wrote this poem called The Charcoal Burners. You'll notice that it has certain implications of a kind with which we're very much concerned in the West nowadays. The Charcoal Burners. Once more the deep blue winter skies dissolve in tenderest green. Once more in purple shadows rise the hills. Once more is seen Eve's first faint star. And lo, once more the charcoal burners pass my door. First gnarled old men, then cheerful boys, with young men in the pride and blush of opening manhood's joys, plod up the mountain side. And after, sharing all they do, red-shawled, blue-skirted women too. Up the long, winding mountain road, with naked, sturdy limbs, each bears his black, dull-gleaming load before the red light dims. With broad, bowed backs and labouring breath, like lost souls on the road to death. The sweat drops tell how far away that world where fancy sees the glooms wherein they heard all day a noise of falling trees, and saw to charcoal slowly turning the beauty of the forest burning. What tongue can tell, what happy flight of fancy air discover, how many trees that loved the light were stricken from their lover? How many forests filled with breath charred into hideousness and death? Year after year this mountain road remorseless will they tread, like death's own self, with ghastly load, till the forests are all dead, like man himself, that will not cease till he has ruined nature's peace. I must say, during my time in Kalimpong, I was very much dismayed to see so many trees being cut down for burning or making into charcoal. And I used to talk to my Nepalese friends about this and say, well, look, to see what is happening. It's not just that you're cutting down trees. These trees have roots. These roots go deep into the soil. This soil is a very thin layer of topsoil on a very steep hillside. Eh? After all, we're in the hills. So no trees, no roots. No roots, no topsoil, because the rains come, the heavy rains, and they wash it all away. And this was what was happening in Kanibong during the 14 years I was there. The soil was being washed away, and there were tremendous landslides. And whole villages would be swept away, and people would be killed. But the Nepalese still just went on chop, chop, chopping the trees down. I'm not quite sure what the position is now. In some ways, I rather dread to go back and see. But this is obviously a question of a very wider significance than that of simply charcoal burners in Kanipong, as you can well imagine. But there's a happier side to trees and the woods, and this next poem is devoted to that aspect. It's called In the Woods Are Many More. Selling wild orchids at my door one day, a man said, in the woods are many more. Deep in the gloom, high on the thick-set trees, wild orchids hang like clouds of butterflies, golden and white, spotted with red and black, as huge as birds, or tiny as a bee. Wild orchids which no eye has ever seen, save ours, who wander in these rich green glooms all day throughout the year. I bought his sprays, paid him, and bore them in. And as I went, my eyes by chance fell on a shelf of books, the Buddha's teachings, and thereafter glanced up to the Buddha's image as he smiled above them from the alcove. Strange it was that, as my eyes from book to image passed, dwelling an instant on that calm, pure face, there, with the frail, cold blossoms in my hands, the words that man spoke at my door should ring through my stilled heart again and yet again, like music, in the woods are many more. But of course, I wasn't serious all the time. There were humorous moments, and there were even humorous poems. And I'm going to read one of the, I must admit, not very many humorous poems that I wrote at that particular time. It's on a subject you may or you may not have heard about, the subject of the Yeti. The Yeti, the so-called abominable snowman. And he, or she, or it, was very much in the news at that particular time, 1952. I think that was the time when, in England, everyone was thinking about the coronation, but in Kalimpong and that part of the Himalayas and other places too, the talk was all about the Yeti, the abominable snowman. So I wrote this poem about the abominable snowman, and that's what it's called, and it's in three parts. Part one, where the ice glitters, where untrodden snows stretch soft and soundless, where a raw wind blows, the abominable snowman comes and goes. Oft the lone mountaineer, through a swarm of snowflakes whose white dance presages storm, has glimpsed the naked giant's fearful form. While oft the hermit, solitary quite, has heard him howling all the winter's night, and toward the monster winged a shaft of light. But whether these be tales or no, by day, a thing of dread for all who pass that way, deep in the snow the giant footprints splay. Two. Appear, as soon as newspapers are able to send reporters, photos of the fable, and hot words flow at many a breakfast table. Pundits in London, Paris and Berlin let loose at once a loud but learned din, all arguing not for truth but just to win. I'm sure there must have been a bear about. Nonsense, a monkey's paw, without a doubt. A human footprint by the wind splayed out. Pamphlets fly back and forth as Dr. D refutes Professor M, though all agree a snowman's footprint it could never be. 3. Yet still, despite 100 learned no's, or shining glaciers through unruffled snows, the legendary creature comes and goes. But even if one day the truth came out that it was ape or bear they'd fussed about, I should not think my faith had suffered rot. Nor could I share the gleeful scholar's pride that, thanks to science, another myth had died, and one more fact been neatly classified. Rather than one of that all-knowing band, I'd be a Sherpa or Tibetan and believe there are some things we don't understand. I'll write another orchid poem. I'm told this one is symbolical, but let's see. It's called Inaccessible. I saw one misty morning an orchid on a tree, and like a flute of silver its blossoms called to me. The plaintive cry of beauty that mid decay is born, I heard there standing breast deep in sparkling dews of dawn, and longed to pluck those mauve sprays, too high, alas, for me, from the shadow-weaving branches of that old and moss-draped tree. Manjunatha has referred to the fact that I was quite busy in Kalimpong and did quite a lot. But I must admit, I must confess that occasionally I did take it a bit easy. And this poem is devoted to that topic, and it's called Summer Afternoon. You can imagine me in the garden of the Hermitage in Kalimpong. Now it is early summer, and the woods ring all day with the cuckoo's double cry. The heat grows week by week, and from the blue intolerable heavens beats the sun, fiercer and fiercer on the huge red flowers that droop among the grasses. Dragonflies in their bright sapphire mail hang glitteringly upon the fountain's edge, four gauze wings poised for instant flight. At peace amid the sights and sounds of nature, with a drowsy cat limp on my knee, and an unheeded book of poems slipping down into my lap unread, I dream away the quiet hours. Don't seem to have so many quiet hours nowadays. But it wasn't all quiet at the Hermitage, and as Manjunatha also mentioned, I was really quite young at the time, and I hadn't sorted everything out by any means. Not that I've even sorted it all out now, come to that. But I probably had more to sort out then, let's put it this way, than I have now. And I sometimes used to just walk up and down, pace up and down, if you like, the garden path, quite literally, just thinking, just going over things in my own mind, or experiencing things, and yes, trying to sort it out, as very likely some of you do these days, sometimes at least. There's no title The title is simply that the first line, up and down the gravel path. So you must just imagine me in my yellow robe, pacing up and down. Aged 26. Up and down the gravel path, between the flowering trees, I've walked this summer afternoon to give my spirit ease. I could not idly stand, nor sit upon the grassy ground, for like a mill wheel in my head, the thoughts flew round and round. O thoughts of life and thoughts of death, chaste thoughts of love and pain, like golden hawk and sable dove, inside my reeling brain. The withered hopes like wind-whirled leaves thick on my heart did come, with dreads like shapes that dance for blood about the sorcerer's drum. So up and down the shadowy paths, between the moon-white trees, through pools of silver, I must walk to give my spirit ease. Lastly, a little poem about the mountains, the river, and it's called The Ashes of All My Heartaches. The ashes of all my heartaches, the dust of 100 dreams, are swept away in an instant when forth one white peak gleams. After long storm and struggle, my heart with quietness fills at the curve of this jade-green river, the sweep of these dark blue hills.